Here is a program transcribed earlier from Mutual.
Now it's time for the friendly voice of Fraser Hunt, brought to you each weekday, Monday through Friday, over the Mutual Broadcasting System. Fraser Hunt, world traveler and world reporter, brings you the latest news, his own expert comment on the puzzling issues of the day, and those touching human interest stories for which he is famous. And now, Fraser Hunt.
Hi, everybody. Well, President Truman calls spokesmen for both sides of the coal dispute back to the White House today. They're going to make another try at breaking their long deadlock. But the signs are hardly encouraging for the 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time conference this morning, which brings United Mine Worker Chief John L. Lewis and Charles O'Neill, representing the operators, once again together. The head-on collision of these two over the miners' demands for a welfare fund already has threatened the whole future of the negotiations. According to Secretary of Labor Schwellenbach, the principal question to be determined today is whether it is worthwhile to ask the UMW and the industry representatives to reopen negotiations. Their discussions have been broken off indefinitely yesterday, but they'll try again today. And establishment of a union-controlled health and welfare fund, the same demand which has stymied negotiations in the soft coal industry, emerged today as the leading issue in the anthracite hard coal contract talks being held here in New York. The United Mine Workers Union declared that the accident toll and mortality rate among anthracite miners was unsurpassed in any other industry. In Washington, government officials today pushed plans for seizure of the nation's railroads if necessary to forestall a strike set for Saturday. They hoped, however, for a happy break into today's negotiations between the carriers and brotherhoods of railroad trainmen and locomotive engineers. President Truman has said he will not hesitate to take over the lines if that action becomes necessary. Trainmen President Whitney said that the railroads had promised an answer today on the union's wage demand. He refused to confirm that the original request for a $2.50 day increase has been lowered to $1.60. CIO President Philip Murray says Americans are entitled to a minimum guaranteed annual wage and that his United Steelworkers Union will demand that kind of pay in 1947 contract negotiations. It is the opinion of your officers that the steel industry can pioneer in the field of minimum guaranteed wages, Murray told the Steelworkers' Third Biennial Convention in Atlantic City yesterday. The United States was confident that the United Nations Security Council would approve its plan to head off for 2 months a contest with Russia over Albania's application for UN membership. American officials indicated they could count on at least 7 votes, the minimum required for passage, when the U.S. membership resolution is acted on by the Council, which meets this morning. Soviet delegate Gromyko was expected to rejoin the United Nations Security Council today. There's a possibility that he may encounter an Australian challenge to explain what he claims is the effect of his absence from council meetings. And the UN Commission on Human Rights, with its final report to the Economic and Social Council blocked by the opposition of a Russian representative, convenes today for another effort to win approval for its recommendations. The Soviet delegate, Brasov, clashed with Mrs. Franklin Roosevelt, Commission chairman yesterday, when he refused to approve the report because of his objections to 2 of the recommendations. In Naples, 31 persons were wounded by hand grenades today when monarchists tried to rush communists barricaded inside communist headquarters. 5 of the wounded were in critical condition. 20 communists were arrested. Arab leaders said today they believed King Farouk of Egypt was organizing a campaign to halt a swing of Arab states towards Russia. They made clear they do not expect Soviet help in Palestine. Across the world, in Japan, acting Foreign Minister Yoshida was appointed Premier of Japan by Emperor Hirohito today after receiving the endorsement of General MacArthur. Yoshida immediately began formation of his cabinet, expected to be a coalition of liberal and conservative parties. And down in Argentina, Foreign Minister Juan Cook characterized today as outside of all that's legal and real, an assertion by former Secretary of Treasury Henry Morgenthau Jr. that Argentina is seeking to organize an anti-democratic, anti-American fascist bloc in South America. The possibility of post-war trade competition between two huge economic blocs, One Anglo-American, the other Russian, became a factor in the British loan consideration when it was acknowledged today to be true by Secretary of Treasury Vinson. But he voiced the long-range hope that all such economic blocks might somehow be eliminated. A tall, ruddy army officer determined to spend the remaining years of his life by the side of his wife in a Carville, Louisiana leprosarium was undaunted today by unofficial word from Carville that his request probably would be denied. This possible setback came as friends of 65-year-old Major Hans George Hornsbussel, a veteran of two wars and of the death march from Bataan, pushed his petition in Washington. Mrs. Hornbussel, who is 52, developed the dread skin trouble while she and her husband and three children were prisoners of the Japs at Santo Tomas internment camp. Her husband wishes to share her fate in voluntary exile, surely a brave, pathetic hope. And now I'll be back with more news in just a few moments.
What do you know about veterans? From now on, the rapid reemployment and readjustment of our returning veterans will be of top priority importance to our country's welfare. So here are a few facts that everyone should know. The skills, education, and experience which our servicemen and women acquired in the armed forces, the know-how which proved so deadly to our enemies in the war, these can be invaluable assets to this nation in peace. In many instances, the work servicemen did in the war was a projection of what business and industry are undertaking in this post-war period. Many veterans who have already returned to civilian life have discovered that their service experience can mean better jobs and greater responsibilities than they were able to assume before the war. The general public, as well as employers, should know and realize the assets of the veteran as a citizen and as an employee. Not only were one half of all service jobs directly related to civilian occupations, but all service jobs were related to civilian occupations in some way. Today, thousands of employers all over the country who are employing veterans testify to the fact that these men are making good. So if you have a job open or know of one, you can do no better than to give a veteran an opportunity to show what he can do. They can and will make good. And now back to Frazier Hunt.
I'd like to read you a memorable human document, but before I bring you the letter, I want to explain that 11 years ago this spring, I made a survey of conditions over America, and one of my earliest stopping places was Morgantown, West Virginia. Near Morgantown, I visited half-abandoned mining sites in a community called Scott's Run. Later, I reported what I had seen in a series of articles in the Good Housekeeping magazine. I give this preface so that you may understand certain of the references in the letter that I am now going to read. Dear Mr. Hunt, as you read this, I doubt if you will recall the name you will find herein. As for myself, I do not quite understand why I write to you now, except that I listen to your broadcast every morning, and I always enjoy it, especially the human interest items. I realize they are intended to touch the human heart. Then, too, I wonder what is your opinion of the health and welfare fund for which the miners are now striking. I couldn't help wondering if you remember what you described years ago as the cluster of shacks that house, like forgotten animals, the human beings who once got and still get their living in the soft, cold mines here that are a tragedy in themselves. Well, the war to end wars has done little or nothing to make those pits safe for the human beings who drudge in them. And as I remember my parents and home life, has done nothing for the human wreckage that comes out of them. If you are still pondering the location of my thoughts, it is what you described as the brown and gray-scarred hillside of Scott's Run. You might possibly recall a woman in the faded sunbonnet whom you judged in your article to be 50, but who was really 56. She was my mother, and as well the mother of 12 other children, all of whom by some incredible miracle are still living, as you wrote. My parents have now left this vale of tears. 5 years after your visit to that humble home in the Scott's Run area, my mother died of ailments which could have been cared for had there been a health and welfare fund to provide for her. She had not sufficient food during those lean years to maintain physical strength to stand the necessary operations which she should have had there been a fund to have cared for the family of a miner crippled in the mines. I doubt if you would have believed, as you talked to my mother that long ago day, that there was a time when her fierce pride would not allow her to accept the charity in any form. She could only accept we could only accept the money we worked for, and then only according to our work. Many times, people better off than ourselves would offer us clothing far more valuable than 10 or 25 cents we earned, but she would have none of it. She would tell us to buy a piece of material and that she would sew it for us. It hurt to watch that pride decay in the filth and stench of that hovel. In September of 1948, my father fell from a ladder, a fall which a few hours later caused his death. The fall, in all probability, was due to his lame leg, which was injured in the coal mine. He was never able to obtain work after his injury, and yet he received only $30 a month pension for a little over 2 years. I was forced to quit school at the age of 14, and when I would have been in the second year of high school with honor roll grades to my credit. I had no proper clothing, no money for books, no money for bus fare to and from the Morgantown High School, for at that time, there were no school buses in our county. At the time of your visit, I was living about a mile above my mother's shack and was myself the mother of a tiny, crippled child suffering from malnutrition. Thanks to better times since those awful days, her anemia has been overcome, and at present, I am the mother of two lovely, healthy girls, 13 and 8. We have purchased a small home here, just a mile or two from the State University. And if my husband should suddenly be injured in these unsafe mines, I doubt if I could possibly care for my children and finish paying for our home without some form of assistance other than that which now exists. Something is wrong in this beautiful, blessed country of ours. I do not know if America is, as you said in your article in 1934, dreaming again. If so, I'm afraid it's not a pleasant dream, but rather a nightmare such as one might have after gorging himself on the wrong kind of food. Forgive me and forget it all. If this has been tiresome to you, most sincerely, yours. Well, my dear friend, it has certainly not been tiresome to me, and I am very glad you wrote me so frankly, for no one seems to bother much about your side of the story. And surely, that's something worth thinking about. Now, here's a most interesting case, and I'd like to know what you listeners think of it. Here's the story. Mr. and Mrs. Paul Moss live out in Astoria, Long Island. They're a quiet, home-loving couple and go to bed early every evening. Right over them in the same apartment house live Mr. and Mrs. Frank Adragna. Now, the Adragnas own a dog, and this dog is a friendly, frisky fellow. Mr. Adragna works late, and when he comes home every night about 10 o'clock, of course, his dog, who has been missing him all day, jumps around on him and barks his welcome. You know how it is with a dog and a master. But unfortunately, this barking and frisking around wakes up Mr. and Mrs. Paul Moss downstairs. It became so bad that they took the case to court before Magistrate Surplice, who ruled, it's true that dogs that live in an apartment need some consideration and exercise. Then he added, but human beings who live in apartments also deserve consideration. And do you know what? Well, the judge adjourned the case until the end of the month with the expressed hope that maybe the Mosses and the Dragners could work out the problem of the poor little dog between the two of them. Well, I wonder who is right anyway. Certainly the dog isn't all to blame. And now, thanks for the visit.
Emergency Food Collection has been created to provide generous Americans with a simple, direct, and personal means of giving quick, additional help to the millions of starving people overseas. You can make a cash contribution through them now. You have been listening to the friendly voice of Fraser Hunt, bringing you the latest news, his own expert comment on the puzzling issues of the day, and those touching human interest stories for which he is famous. Fraser Hunt, world traveler and world reporter, is heard every weekday, Monday through Friday, at this same time. Tomorrow, another visit with Fraser Hunt.
Fraser Hunt's commentary was transcribed earlier from Mutual for presentation to the West Coast at this time. This is the Mutual Don Lee Broadcasting System.